After the defeat of Amendment 1, what's the future for solar energy here in Florida? A closer look just ahead. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or through the WJCT app. It's a rainy, dark morning out there, but we're looking at a bright picture as the founder of A1A Solar talks about the expansion of solar energy here in the Sunshine State. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Give us a call. Then later, overtime rules for salaried employees are on hold after a ruling by a federal judge. A closer look at what that might mean for your paycheck. Plus, it's our latest segment of Rising Stars featuring local artist Odd Rod. All of that ahead. But first, this hour, the picture is brightening for solar power here in the Sunshine State. The largest solar panel installer in the country says it's going to move into the Florida residential market. This after the state's voters last month rejected a utility-backed ballot measure that critics said would have made expanding into solar more expensive. That was the controversial Amendment 1. It went down to defeat in November. Now, Solar City, a California-based subsidiary of electric car maker Tesla Motors, said last week, it's going to open an operations center in Orlando and expand into other parts of the state. There are already local players on the solar scene, and they are plotting their strategy as their business market opens up for solar power. Pete Wilking is founder and CEO of A1A Solar here in Northeast Florida, and he joins us now with what he hopes is a sunny outlook for his industry. Pete Wilking, good morning.
Well, good morning, Melissa. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
So good to have you on the show. And here's our question to callers. Amendment 1, a controversial utility-backed amendment, went down to defeat in November. Does this clear the path for the expansion of solar, residential solar in particular, on your roof here in Florida? What are your questions about solar energy? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet the show, or weigh in on our Facebook page. And so the voters decisively rejected Amendment 1, Pete, on November 8th, even though in the early going it was polling pretty well. But they didn't buy the argument that it would help solar. Instead, critics said it would have actually hindered the growth of residential solar power in Florida. Your thoughts about Amendment 1, first off?
Well, first off, we're really glad that Amendment 1 failed. It was pro-solar, but it was pro-solar at the utility scale level and not so much on the rooftop level. And people in the green community, the solar community, we believe that the rooftop solar component is such an important part of our transition to renewables as as a form of energy for all of us to do. Mm-hmm. So this keeps the door open for solar where should Amendment 1 have passed, it would have allowed the utility companies to basically dictate solar policy, which typically would not favor rooftop solar.
Which is a big part of your business, A1A Solar.
Yes, we are a rooftop solar contractor, residential and commercial.
Right. And so you're having competition now as we're learning that the biggest solar player in America, Solar City, is eyeing Florida now. They saw how this vote went and they're moving into Orlando and possibly Jacksonville. We don't know yet, but there's definitely a growing market in this state.
Absolutely. We actually have offices in Orlando as well. And I know this sounds ironic, but I'm actually glad that Solar City is coming to Florida because they bring more awareness to the solar industry. There'll be some more selection for people to choose a solar contractor. And quite honestly, I don't have enough capacity to put solar on every home in the state of Florida, so I need a little help.
Uh-huh. Well, you're going to get it. Solar City, owned by or acquired by Tesla, CEO Elon Musk is the chair. And he wants to also sell solar panels through Tesla stores so people can use them to power their electric vehicles, not just their homes. So, but in terms of your business, A1A Solar, how is it a challenge for you? Because in many states, a solar company like yours can sell the power directly to the consumer. In Florida, only utility companies can sell directly to the consumer.
Well, that only really becomes an issue with PPA, power purchase agreements. So for self-consumption and net metering, that's really not an issue. Currently, part of Solar City's business model was solar leases on that. And but to a large part, The trend is moving toward ownership of the systems rather than doing a lease PPA type structure. So that the that issue is not as big a burden as you think it might be.
And how do you expect our local utility, JEA, to react to this playing field?
Well, it's interesting. You know, we've had our bouts with JEA policy concerning rooftop solar. Moving forward now, I would expect the bigger utility companies to address some policy changes, not just for rooftop solar, but for bill structures in general, as the nature of electricity and billing is a little bit different than it had been historically. Mm-hmm. So we should expect JEA to be coming out with some policies. In fact, at the last board meeting, we, A1A Solar, addressed the board to see if we could offer to be a part of a joint committee so that we can come up with a more common ground than, say, dissimilar ground on formulating a policy that works for them and the green community. So we hope they take us up on that offer.
We'll go to your calls in just a moment for Pete Wilking, the CEO of A1A Solar, as we look at this expanding sector in Florida. It's 549-2937. And, of course, your bread and butter is residential rooftop solar. For people that have considered this, thought about the benefits, and have hesitated, how do you sell them?
Well, for somebody who owns a home, they pay taxes and they're not buried in trees, typically we can do something for them. A typical customer, let's just say they have a $150 to $200 electric bill. We don't get rid of the electric bill. A typical customer, we may get rid of anywhere from 70 to 90% of the electric bill, even if we make them net zero, where the system would actually harvest as many kilowatt hours in a year as they would consume. But since it's a 30-year asset, there is capital cost involved. So just like if you buy a car or whatever, another
it's
capital
like
asset,
buying a car, you finance it.
Yeah, you finance it. So our typical loan is a 12-year loan. So you make payments on that, and the payments are roughly equivalent to what the drop in the electric bill would be. So the barriers for putting solar on a home are very low these days, as they're very bankable. We have a number of loan products that are offered, and if people want to pay cash or do a loan, home equity line of credit, those are the ways of financing it. So it's one of the few home improvements that actually pays for itself.
It definitely increases the resale value of a home.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it reduces carbon footprint. And it actually helps the utility company buy another source power going into the grid to help stabilize some of the voltage regulation. So there are benefits to the utility company and ratepayers in terms of adding capacity. And furthermore, this is part of an extended infrastructure that, as the utility companies add utility-scale energy storage, they will need this abundance of, I don't want to say free power, but available solar power to charge batteries or spool up flywheels to be used at night, making their plants more efficient.
So you're glad that Amendment 1 went down to defeat. More and more consumers are interested in your product, but there are still challenges. What keeps you up at night, Pete Wilking?
Well, when you have 45 employees running an enterprise in two cities, certainly I've got my work cut out for me. Luckily, I have a wonderful team and management team that helps us get this done. Really, the challenges are customer acquisition. Because these systems last so long, we have to spend an extraordinary amount of time and energy and resources acquiring customers, educating customers, let them know you know, what it's all about. Probably at least 30% of the people that are interested in solar are not good solar candidates. So just because they're interested in it doesn't mean they're a good candidate. So,
who's a good candidate?
People that don't have much shade, owner-occupied activity, and if they have tax load where they're paying federal taxes, they can take advantage of the incentives that are at the federal level.
What are the incentives?
The federal government has offered, and that was the energy bill of 2006? A 30% federal tax credit, and it's both for residential and commercial. So basically, it's a bottom line credit or discount on what you owe in taxes for the federal government. So most people can take put in a system on their house and have several thousand dollars of tax credit, which reduces their tax load. In that same bill, there's also on the commercial side accelerated depreciation on there. So that further amplifies the economics on commercial solar.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Pete Wilking, CEO of A1A Solar, a look ahead at the future of renewable and solar power here in Florida. What are your questions? 549-2937. William is in Northeast Jacksonville. Hi, William. Good morning.
Hey,
Good hope morning. You're staying dry up there where you are.
Yeah, it's been pretty rainy this morning. My question is actually a desire to compare what our government does to incentivize solar versus what the government of Germany has done to incentivize solar. And if you look over in Germany, and forgive the inaccuracy, the percentage of their energy supplied by solar is outstandingly high. And what could we do? Because, you know, the problem is solar is expensive, even for, you know, these programs, financing, whatever else. You know, back when solar was far more expensive, Germany managed to, you know, incentivize in such a way that you see solar roofs absolutely everywhere. What can we do legislatively to incentivize it better so that it's not, you know, akin to buying a new car for average homeowners like myself?
Sure. Thanks, William. And I think he speaks for a lot of your potential customers.
Yes. Germany and, you know, even Gainesville Regional had some what's called an affidavit tariff, where when you send or when you generate solar or renewable energy, they're willing to pay you a price above the retail price of electricity. And so what that did is it really jumpstart the market to get a whole bunch of solar out there. The problem with these type programs is when the money runs out or they meet their goals, it pretty much flatlines the industry. So I agree that there should be incentives to do it. I'm a little careful to say, oh, we should be, you know, throwing all these incentives. I'm not a real big fan of large incentives because it doesn't promote steady growth of the industry. I think if we can just remove the barriers, keep what we have in place with the 30%, and not allow policies that are too detrimental to the solar growth, I think we're doing okay right now.
But Florida has been compared unfavorably with other states in terms of policies that would help your business.
Yeah, you know, other states, particularly in the West Coast and the Northeast, they've had some very aggressive incentive programs where utility companies or the states are using tax dollars or ratepayer dollars to heavily incentivize people going solar. And that's really good for the customer and really good to get some numbers on the board. But again, these programs typically have a sunset to them, and it's really disastrous to the industry when you spend all this money to spool up a company and have a presence and all that, and you're using that as your sole basis to be able to make a sale. So I think it's better to have a sustainable policy so that you don't have these swings and cause what we call it in the industry, the solar coaster, the ups and downs of the industry.
The solar coaster. Mike on the south side. Hi, Mike.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. This is a terrific topic. I'm always glad to see topics like this getting floated on this show. This is awesome.
Sure.
Just had a couple of quick questions. One is we keep hearing the phrase net metering is often used a lot in conjunction with solar. And I'll confess, as much as I think I might know about it, there's probably a lot of gaps in my knowledge. So if we might be able to talk a little bit about what net metering is and how it impacts this issue. Second question, I just read that the cost per kilowatt hour for solar has now gone below virtually every other form of energy production in America. Can you comment to the accuracy of that and whether or not we probably will see it continue to go down as far as a cost factor goes? And I'll take the answer off the air. Thanks, and look forward to hearing the answer.
Bye. Thanks, Mike. Mm-hmm.
Sure. Net metering is really the concept where if a customer puts solar on their home, they get full retail credit for what they pull from the utility company and what they send to the utility company. Mm-hmm. That was put forth in the Florida Constitution basically to promote the growth of solar and not allow policies that would be detrimental for the growth of solar. So that was the reason we have net metering in there. And kind of that was pretty much the one of the basis for Amendment 1 to come up play to eventually overturn that net metering rule. And really when it comes to net metering, what the utility companies are most concerned about is what the value of that backfed electricity or excess energy, as they call it, that's really the source of issue with the utility companies. So right now, the consumer is protected on that. Other states, it's interesting because the state of Georgia does not have net metering. So when we put solar on a Georgia place, the amount of credit that a customer gets from the utility company is a pure fraction. So the utility company is really benefiting heavily when a customer goes solar in the state of Georgia, disproportionately. So net metering is a way to promote and protect customers that are choosing renewables on that. What was the second question?
I think I'm not sure. I was so fascinated by your answer that I can't remember the other half of his question. Oh, cost per meter. Oh. Cost per meter.
Oh, cost per watt. Okay,
yeah.
For the cost of solar.
Yeah.
Well, when I got in the industry about 10 years ago, a solar panel cost about $1,500, and now it's dropped roughly 80%. So the cost of solar panels has dropped markedly. The technology in terms of reliability is fantastic. But the soft costs of solar have not gone down. In fact, they've gone up. The insurances, racking material, all kinds of new equipment has come out to drive the cost down. But when it comes to the panels themselves, we're probably not going to see much lower on there. But we're seeing... this year, there's been some drops in equipment costs, and we've lowered our prices in the last 6-8 months, passing on those costs to our customers.
Tracy is in Mandarin. Hi, Tracy. Thanks for holding.
Hi.
Good morning.
Okay. Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
Can I? Okay. We are in our 70s. My husband did not ask me. He's going to put solar system, so it was put 2 years ago. What I see is, I thought, oh, we'll have a swimming pool will be heated. Not only we are paying for the finance every month, the JEA bill did not drop much. So, you know, we may not live another 10 years. So when we wanted to sell the house, you have to pay this bill if you want to sell the house until it is paid. So it will become extra burden on us. We have not seen much difference in our billing in the last 2 years. On top of that, we are paying the finance charges. I feel bad about it. We did it. But maybe 10 years later, we won't be alive, so we will see it. I have no idea. Thank you, sir. Have your comment to us.
Okay. Thanks, Tracy.
I think she mentioned she had a solar pool heating system on.
Yeah.
We're really talking about solar electric or photovoltaics.
Right.
Solar pool heating system, unless you're using, say, an electric heater or gas heater, is not going to affect your electric bill, but it will heat your pool on that. So I think we're talking a different subject, photovoltaic versus solar thermal, pool heating and domestic hot water. And those are two solar technologies that A1A Solar does not offer. We're specifically focused on solar electric, photovoltaic, residential, commercial.
On the roof, yeah. And not so much commercial? I mean, is it more a home-based business that you go into? Are you doing more business solar these days?
Yes, we are. In fact, there appears to be a very good market for the commercial solar electric and A1A Solar. We've actually set up a division there to focus on doing more commercial photovoltaic installs.
We're going to go to your calls in just a moment. At 549-2937, as we continue our conversation with Pete Wilking, CEO of A1A Solar. But first, a couple of tweets for you. Here's one from Adam. Actually, a couple from Adam. Will you be able to sell or install Elon Musk's panels? We are very happy with our panels from A1A Solar. And if you can't sell Tesla's panels, he says, what new technology is coming available to residential rooftop solar over the next few years?
Sure, be glad to answer that. Well, Tesla, which acquired Solar City a couple weeks ago. They've launched, or at least a news launch, of a new solar product. It's basically a solar shingle, kind of high-end. It looks beautiful. It's a roof-integrated photovoltaic product. I'm moderately excited about it, but I think it's going to be a very limited market. It's going to be very expensive, and it's basically going to be for high-end new construction type applications. So I'm a little hesitant to say it's going to revolutionize the industry from that product. Hmm. What I am excited about is Tesla is coming out with the Powerwall 2.0. The first Powerwall had its limitations. It didn't have a built-in inverter. It had the energy storage in it, but it was, from an installer standpoint, it was complex. The Powerwall 2.0, it seems to be a venerable product in terms of technology, what it can do, and its price points. So it's really going to be instrumental in developing the residential energy storage market. And this is important because a lot of utility companies, particularly on the West Coast, they have billing structures, demand charges, time of use charges, that even if you're not going off grid or grid down scenario, helps you control your billing amount with that energy storage. So this is pretty exciting. We do offer battery systems. Right now we're offering the Sonnen battery, which is German technology, lithium ion. It's a great system. It's at a higher price point of the Powerwall 2.0. But unfortunately, neither the Tesla shingle or the Powerwall 2.0 is available at this time, and sometimes they do limited distribution. So we're going to have to wait and see on availability on those.
Meanwhile, here's an email for you from Rob in Murray Hill. I'm happy to say my wife and I have installed solar on our roof 2 months ago. To date, we've saved more than 3,000 pounds of carbon. I believe that our generation is used by our neighbors, and I wish the cost of burning fossil fuels was calculated in the cost of producing energy, including health and environmental impacts. So people are motivated to buy your product for a number of reasons.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing because one of the issues is the value of solar, or the value of renewables, and typically we spend about 10 cents per kilowatt hour before taxes and fees on our electric bill, and you know that's kind of a local average at least. But when you look at the true value of solar in terms of environmental impact, health impact, and all that, some calculations roughly double that. It put the cost of society about 10 cents a kilowatt hour. So so we're not really paying that cost of environmental impact, health impact in our electricity. So currently, there's no penalty for it, and how we resolve that, I don't have the answer.
Ron is in St. Augustine Beach. Hey, Ron. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to make a comment. I've been in Florida about 20 years, but I spent the last 3 years up in New England, New York, and New Jersey, and there's solar panels all over the place up there. You talk to people... you can go to a company and lease a system with no out-of-pocket expense. They come and install the system. You cut the one check to the solar company. You're paying less per kilowatt hour, and then you check. Then you cut another check to the utility for whatever excess need you need. It's just so surprising down here in Florida, and I think it's because of the political climate that the solar industry is so far behind here. We have a governor here that has just fought tooth and nail against any sort of solar industry, and that's one of the downsides. Also, I think your talker there is good, but the federal tax incentives are excellent, actually, to get the ball rolling. And that's why you see so many panels in the Northeast right now, that incentive that got people there. The bottom line is there's solar panels on people's roofs, and lots of them. And that's what happens. That has to be done down here. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Ron. That's been commented on before when we look at this topic, Pete. We are the Sunshine State, but we are lagging behind other states that have a lot less days of sunshine. Callers like Ron say it's due to our culture and our politics. What do you think?
The price of electricity generally in the Southeast is pretty low. And when you go West Coast and the Northeast, the price of electricity is a lot higher. So you combine that with the economics of going solar, it makes it perhaps an easier sale. You throw state incentives or utility incentives on top of that, and then you get a massively cash flow positive proposal. So like in New Jersey, when they were having what they call SRECs on there, I mean, it was a frenzy. It was a frenzy of everybody getting solar, commercial, residential, and all that. And it was funded by taxpayers, of course. But again, they hit the solar coaster when the program ran out. It pretty much crashed the solar industry. So yes, it was good for a bump there. But in terms of growing, having a consistent industry, I don't think it's good for that. I think a slow and steady growth is better than these big explosions and then crashes when it comes to a policy formulation.
We have so many calls for Pete Wilking of A1A Solar. We'll go back to the phones in just a moment. But first, here's a comment for you on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Mick asks, Elon Musk announced roof tiles that also are solar panels. Do you think this will become popular? And what about installing battery systems? I think you talked about that a little already.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about that. The neat thing is there's so much innovation in the solar field, particularly when it comes to panels, power density. Elon's roof integrated solar product is really neat, but it's going to have a limited market, in my opinion. Like I said before, energy storage at the residential and commercial market segment is going to be growing. And it's been basically a cost factor. You have to get the total cost of this at a level where it makes financial sense. Some of that is driven by utility policies. If the utility companies have exorbitant policies that kind of zing you on that, it makes much more cost effective to go batteries. So I would like to comment on energy storage. That's been kind of the holy grail for the energy sector. FPL just recently announced a rate hike, which was predictable. I think it was somewhere around a 6 or 7% rate hike on their fees. But in that proposal, they actually are going to be investing in a 50 megawatt utility scale battery system. And I think I applaud them for those efforts because utility scale storage is going to be a growing sector. In fact, there's some European companies that use flywheel storage for that, and I think that's fascinating technology for the utility companies to employ, and I hope more utility companies take a harder look at these technologies.
Dave in Nassau County. Hey, Dave, we have calls from all over the listening area this morning. Hi, Dave. Good morning.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Love the show. I'm glad to hear you guys talking about this. Just a few quick questions. One, what is the basic kind of from the hip average cost to install a solar system on a house? And then my other question is the battery. So if you want to couple that with the battery system, like I'm, you know, hearing, let's say top of the line or medium of the line, what's the life of that battery? And then what's the life of the whole system, the solar panels and the battery? Because if you put it in, and I'm a huge proponent of this and I'm very, very much interested, how long are you going to have the life of the system? Thanks. I'll take my call.
Thanks, Dave.
Sure. I'll give some generalities here. Of course, every home is a little different or business in terms of pricing and roof and electrical work and all that. But, you know, a typical residential typically goes between $18,000 to $50,000 or even more, depending on the size of the house, what type of light, how much electricity we're trying to offset. So there's a big range in there. So, but the economics are roughly the same for each one, depending on how much electricity you're offsetting. Mm-hmm. When you add batteries, you're adding a significant amount of cost, usually $15,000 to $25,000 of cost on top of the solar electric. So there is a capital investment in that. If you're just looking for backup energy, say for a hurricane or something like that, it's a lot cheaper to do a generator, a standby generator in that regard. But if you're looking long term, you want to do peak shaving, you want to have off-grid capability without the generator, then that would be an option. It's not the cheapest one. I tell people if you go batteries, it's pretty much like you're buying an insurance policy. When it comes to the life cycle of a battery system, the Sonnen battery that we're using now, it uses a Sony lithium-ion battery, and it has a a 10,000 charge recharge cycle guarantee. So if you do that, it's over 20 years for the life cycle of that battery. So until the lithium ions came out, battery systems, the weakest part was the lead acid battery itself, because you can only really get 5 to 8 years out of the battery. Then you're looking at a substantial investment to replace the battery. Now, when you get the lithium ion integrated system, it's a fantastic 20 plus year system.
Lots of calls and questions about solar energy. Let's take one more call for Pete Wilking, CEO of A1A Solar, Sarah in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Sarah.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Hi, Pete and Melissa. This is Sarah from U.S. Green Building Council, Florida.
Oh, good morning.
How are you?
Good.
I am calling because, Melissa, you had Michelle Moore from Groundswell in Washington, D.C. Talk about how community solar can be a solution to Jacksonville's energy inequity. We're apparently the number one city with the most energy inequity in the U.S., and I see a lot of potential for solving several problems in that. And also, Pete, I'm interested in your insight on the cooperative solar that's happening in several cities in Florida, like Orlando and I believe in Tampa, like a bulk buying purchase opportunities. And I also want to give a shout out to Pete. He's talking tonight at our U.S. Green Building Council Green Social at the Volstead tonight at 6 p.m.
Yes. Thanks for all of that. Thanks, Sarah Bourne, calling in. Okay.
Okay. For the community solar, as a contractor, we're a specialty contractor, so we price, design, build these systems. Trying to set up a community solar program is really not in our area of expertise, but we would be glad to compete for those type projects. So I think that is a part of it, and we're glad to be participating and installing these as they come up. Probably more importantly is the co-op concept. We're bidding on various co-ops where an organization gets together, basically a not-for-profit. They go into a neighborhood community and they basically say, hey, we'll do a bulk purchase and we'll get a price down here. And then they bid it out to a bunch of qualified contractors. And then it's a good way to remove all the marketing and sales cost that typically the contractor bears when making a sale. It's one big sale, if you will, and then you parse it off as the sales come in. So I see the co-op sale picking up a little bit. Maybe the HOAs would get involved in that. That's a good way to do it, but then it puts them into a contractor selection mode, which can be a little cumbersome and all that. So any way to get solar in to
You're
customers is,
yeah.
It's good for everybody.
This is just a window into tonight's event where you can hear Pete speak about clean energy and solar power. It's a happy hour at the Volstead, sponsored by the local chapter of the U.S. Green Building Council. Susan Glickman, Florida Director of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, will also be on hand. Come on out to that event tonight at 6 o'clock and learn more about this. Meanwhile, Pete Wilking, CEO of A1A Solar, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And later, it's our new segment on the show. Find out this month's rising star, a young up-and-comer on the First Coast. But up next, why American workers hoping for more overtime pay are in limbo. Back in a moment.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
I'm Catherine Burns, one of the hosts of the Moth Radio Hour, and I hope you'll join us here on 89.9 WJCT. With true personal stories told live without notes to standing room crowds around the world, Moth Stories aren't part of the disposable daily information flow. They stick with you, and you'll even find yourself retelling them. Listen Saturdays at 3 p.m. here on 89.9 WJCT.
independent music transcends genre, form, and age. At Indie Endeavor, we endeavor to shine a light in the little explored dark corners of your musical imagination. Everything from new to old, foreign to domestic, electronic to acoustic, we play it all. Indie Endeavor Tuesdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, workers across the country who were slated to make more money starting this month, well, they're now in limbo. This after a federal judge in Texas made a ruling to halt an overtime rule that was supposed to take effect December 1st. This new Labor Department rule would have made overtime pay an option for full-time salaried employees earning up to $47,476 a year. That's substantially more than the current threshold of about $23,000 a year. The rule was challenged in court by business groups and some states. So, as we wait to see how this plays out, what should employees be expecting when it comes to their paycheck? Susie Lemon is CEO and president of Dynamic Corporate Solutions, a full-service human resources firm here on the First Coast. And she joins us now to talk overtime, or rather, the lack of it. Susie, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. And this is a real disappointment for millions of Americans that were excited about possibly getting time and a half pay. Let's explain the lay of the land now for employees that are making at this threshold. Anyone up to it's just under $48,000 a year thought they were going to be getting overtime. Now it's on hold, right?
Well, keep in mind that some organizations did already implement because of December 1 being kind of in the middle of the week, actually a Thursday. So probably many of the employees of larger organizations already implemented. Mm-hmm. Some of the smaller organizations, not-for-profits, and small businesses may have waited until the December 1 date to implement. And so for those, it's kind of in limbo.
And the Labor Department has appealed this decision, so we don't really know what the final word on this will be, correct?
We don't. And, you know, employees are kind of at the mercy of the employer to see what's going to happen. And we recommend and to our clients and others that, you know, they be as transparent as they possibly can with employees to let them know that, you know, they're going to comply with the law. Unfortunately, because it's a stay, there's a stay basically. We don't know when that's going to be lifted. It could be soon if there's an appeal and then the appeals court rules against this judge in Texas, or it may go on and on.
Not only that, companies have approached this in different ways. Some have offered raises so that they'd be above the threshold and they wouldn't put in for overtime. Other employees have moved their workers from salary jobs to hourly, or they've cut their hours back. There have been responses like that as well.
There have, and there's been some reorganization of organizations where they may have changed kind of the mix of employees and management in order to you know, if they didn't have limited dollars in order to pay for it. And, you know, it's hard, especially in the smaller businesses, because they do have limited dollars on how you can accommodate that kind of a big increase. At the same time, employees are working a lot of hours and perceive that they're not being paid for those or being paid at a very low rate. So on the other side of that, from the employee perspective, what's going to happen with that? I do want to point out, though, that some employees did not really want this to change because they had the freedom that comes from being exempt, mm-hmm. and they could come and go as they wanted and not have to do a time card.
Yeah.
So there was also the psychology piece of that with this whole change.
Yeah, people might not necessarily like the idea of punching a card.
People don't, and it is associated with their self-esteem. They feel more important when they don't have to. And so there was that whole piece of it, and some may have been relieved that they don't have to use PTO when they're gone, to the doctor,
right.
And others. When you're exempt, you don't have to do that.
Lots of moving parts to this. At the same time, the Obama White House had pushed for this move, saying that the more Democratic point of view, that people in this country need a raise. They need more money. So this would have made a bigger pot of money available to more workers at that income level. Business groups and other employers said, no, this is going to hurt our bottom line. We just can't afford to pay this. So with President-elect Trump coming in, how do you anticipate this limbo situation to be resolved in terms of that White House?
I think you have to look at whether or not this is even going to be on their radar, you know, whether it's going to be one of the 200-some priorities or promises that were made during the campaign. You know, the Republican Senate and House both are very negative towards this change. So it's hard to say whether it's going to make the priority list. And whether if the appeals court comes in and lifts the injunction, if this will kind of slip through.
Meanwhile, the Economic Policy Institute, that's a more liberal-leaning think tank, says that they're researching options for becoming a party to this lawsuit, even if the Labor Department drops out, trying to keep this alive.
Well, and, you know, this is a law that was passed in 1938. And it has not been really updated. There was an update in the 70s. During the Bush administration, there was an update. Okay, so it's not just the Democrats, it's the Republicans too.
Yeah.
But it's really not a modern law. It doesn't deal with cell phones and people doing email 24/7 a day and
people
all those
feeling that they're really never off work.
So
right.
The law is an issue and it's complicated. And really, the money piece is actually the simplest piece of the law. The most complicated part is the duties test. There's three tests, the salary test, the salary basis test, and the duties test. And with the duties test, your duties have to meet certain criteria in order for you to be exempt. And that's where we see all the lawsuits. And you see that on the news and the radio, and the labor law attorneys they're always out there saying, are you being paid properly? And it's all around the duties test. And that's very blurry.
So what advice are you giving employers right now that are really trying to feel their way through this?
Well, you kind of have to know your organization. So each organization is unique. And, you know, one thing that you want to make sure is you're complying with the law now. You know, it's easy to know whether you're paying 23,660, but also whether you are treating exempt employees like exempt employees and not violating the law in that way. And then, of course, the duties test, which is all gray, because this is the biggest area where you can get sued and do that wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So we're telling them basically you kind of have to take a wait and see approach. If you've already made changes, we don't recommend you change people back. If you've already communicated that, you've already given people raises, it's never a good idea to take money back from employees.
We'll have to keep following this. In the meantime, we appreciate your insights. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Susie Lemon is president and CEO of Dynamic Corporate Solutions. They are a full-service human resources consulting firm here in our area. And in a moment, this month's Rising Star.
On the next I Am Rheem show, several cities, including Boston and Chicago, have vowed not to participate in deportation policies championed by President-elect Trump. And lawmakers in California are moving to limit cooperation with federal immigration agents. A look at so-called sanctuary cities under a Trump presidency.
Weekday mornings at 10 on 89.9.
On WJZT's radio reading service at 8 a.m. weekday mornings, it's 3 hours of news, op-eds, and obituaries from your local newspaper. Here's a call we received from someone who listens online.
I'm very happy to tell you that my daughter found the app for the radio reading service on my tablet, and I'm using that, and it's excellent. I enjoy all the programs.
If you're living with blindness and want to hear what's in the paper, go to wjct.org/radio reading, underwritten by Florida Eye Specialists.
Coming up, 20-year-old violinist Simone Porter on this reflective piece by Ernest Bloch. I feel like this piece travels really through the five stages of grief. It goes very dark, but I think in the end, it arrives at transcendence.
Simone Porter on the next Performance Today from APM. Weeknights at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
That's close.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, he's a local spoken word artist here in the 904 with a growing reputation. Odd Rod, a.k.a. Roderick Borisade, was actually raised in poverty by a drug-addicted single mom. But after a tough childhood, he graduated from UNF on a full scholarship and has built a growing multimedia career. Here on the show, we are starting to feature up-and-coming young professionals around the First Coast. Today, it's Odd Rod, who is our First Coast Connect rising star, and he joins us now with a preview of his show Sunday at Theater Jacksonville. Odd Rod, a pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
How'd you get the name Odd Rod, by the way?
I named myself Odd Rod. It was a tough time, but I thought it'd be different at the time, and I felt like I was going against the odds.
It's not that you're strange, it's that you beat the odds.
And now it's that I'm strange because I do poetry coming from where I came from. So now it's like, you did poetry coming out of the hood and you're making poetry a living? That's strange as well in this day and age.
So you didn't grow up with this? You didn't grow up writing poems and thinking about poems?
Well, it started at 13 and my brother passed away and I wrote a suicide letter, which turned out to rhyme because I was listening to Tupac at the time and I was like, I don't want to rap, but I wrote this suicide letter and that letter actually saved my life. It turned out to be a poem that kept me going because I never saw my feelings written down.
How did it save your life?
By writing it, I had a chance to see what I was going through and I looked at it and I was like, this actually felt good. It was art for me, but back then I didn't know it. I hadn't had a chance to get my feelings out. I had all this stuff in my head. And as soon as I wrote that, I was like, wow, I can actually write. And it felt good to do it. So I continued to document everything that I was going through.
And as I said, you had a really tough childhood, but you worked really hard in school. You got a scholarship to UNF.
Yes.
And then after you left UNF, you had dreams and aspirations of expressing your art.
I did.
And you do it in a multimedia way. You're doing a lot.
A lot. School helped me. I graduated with a multimedia degree in graphic design. So now photography and video, I can take poems and pretty much create as much of a movie as I can. And that's what I've been doing now with my, if you look at any of my social media pages, you'll see great photos and things, especially in my travels. I get to document my everything that I see. Like I'm open to do it. And I got fired, Melissa.
You got fired?
I got fired, and then I got the job back and quit it. I always tell this story.
Well, who fired you?
I was a longshoreman for 12 years. I worked on the El Faro.
No way.
Yeah, I did.
And they fired you from that?
Well, there was a few ships out there, but they fired me because I was trying to pursue my dreams at the time. The company was changing, and I went and got the job back because I didn't feel like being fired, Melissa.
So how'd you convince them to hire you back?
Lawyers, litigation, my union reps.
So Odd Rod has a backbone made of steel, it sounds like.
My grandpa. renegade. I don't want fired on my resume, so I want to quit on my resume. So I quit a couple of weeks after they got me the job back.
Wow. So you kind of got the last word on that.
I did.
And you're all about the words. You're a spoken word artist in addition to all the other art you produce.
Mm-hmm. Mainly a spoken word is driven around that.
So you're going to be doing a show Sunday at Theater Jacksonville. It's called Mind Blown.
Yeah.
By Odd Rod. What's the show all about?
Every year for my birthday, I bring one show back to Jacksonville because I tour the rest of the year and I want to do one show for the city. So my birthday, I was like, I'm going to start doing shows. And I got a guy, Sean Bott, who's a mentalist on there. He is he's really, really talented and amazing. And I see him all the time. And he's flying in from Utah for the show. So the last 2 years, I brought magicians to different places whenever I have the show. So I bring musician, magician, just acts that Jacksonville doesn't think to get. Uh-huh. And that I see on the road all the time. So we'll be bringing Sean in. I'll be performing and the band will be performing. They're called Radio Love. But the whole idea is to have your mind blown by poetry, music, and what I think is magic. Because it's a mentalist, but it's like magic to me.
Yeah. Oh, what they can do is amazing on stage.
It's bananas to me.
And then when you perform, what do you talk about?
I'll tell my life story. And honestly, this will be the first time that I bring the show to Jacksonville. On the road, the audience is allowed to ask questions. And I'm going to open the floor to questions. And in between those questions, I have these poems that kind of drive those questions. So I'll give them about 45 minutes to an hour just to open up. But I want people to see the other acts that I'm bringing as well.
So exciting. And as I said, you're a rising star for the month here on the show. What are your aspirations as you continue to tour and grow? What's your dream now?
Well, thank you for being this rising star. I feel great and honored. The goal is to break out of the college market and do theaters, just like what I'm doing at Theater Jacksonville, because the college market is going to last for so long. I know that one day I'm going to have grays, and those students don't want to hear me at that time.
That's
so
right. That's
somebody
right.
has to replace the outgoing comedians that are no longer our heroes. So I think we need new heroes, and I'll be that person that'll sit on stage in a chair, and I got this beautiful story that I can tell of perseverance.
He's Odd Rod. Go see his show Sunday night at Theater Jax. It's called Mind Blown. Follow him on social media, too, and thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Good to meet you.
Likewise.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes or the WJCT app. Next on Die and Ream, several cities, including Boston and Chicago, have vowed not to participate in deportation policies championed by President-elect Trump. Lawmakers in California are moving to limit cooperation with federal immigration agents, so-called sanctuary cities under a Trump presidency. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again tomorrow at 9 a.m. Stay dry. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.